I just want to add a couple of comments to those that have already been made, because I've been around assisting and learning and helping and actually marveling at the impact of this outreach model that Wayne developed and that we've been using. That, you know, most of the discussion was around injection drug use, but, you know, there were some colleagues at COIP that use this intervention to test with MSM, and, you know, we ended up developing an organization in Chicago that was became a CBO, initially supported by COIP and by Wayne, and allowing us to do this work in among MSM communities in the city, and was specifically targeting African-American and Latino MSM. Proved to be very, you know, the model and you know, ended up being very effective in reaching those folks because, you know, as with IDUs and other marginalized populations that at the time, early in the HIV epidemic, African-American and Latino men of color were, you know, pretty highly stigmatized and concerned about folks knowing their HIV status, and so people kind of, you know, stayed a little bit under the radar. Even in venues that we targeted that were predominantly, you know, gay-identified venues, there were still those kind of dynamics going on. So the intervention, the idea of using men, you know, from the community to do that work to be able to provide HIV prevention messages was really powerful. And again, same thing with TB. So not just populations, but, you know, other health issues. We had a TB grant that we just talked about a minute ago that was very effective. So anyway, I just wanted to add that to the points that were already raised. So for my presentation, I want to talk a little bit about application of the model to assisting the city doing surveillance. So basically, this discussion focuses on work that the Department of Health is doing through CDC funding and a little bit of background. So anyway, here's what I hope to do in this presentation: describe the different ways that utilizing COIP's Indigenous Leader Outreach Model helps facilitate implementation of these surveillance activities that I'll talk about in a minute, and promotes more effective understanding of and access to the target population. So I'm kind of old school. I got notes here that I'm gonna read from. So in terms of the background, a little bit of background about the National HIV Behavioral Surveillance System. In 2000, CDC and representatives from state and local health departments, academic institutions, and clinical and prevention organizations initiated a strategic planning process that led to the development of CDC's first HIV prevention strategic plan that went through 2000. And as part of this plan, they had four goals that were identified to reduce the annual number of new infections in half. One of these goals was to strengthen the national capacity to monitor the HIV epidemic and to better direct and evaluate prevention efforts, which has been ended up being further highlighted in the last national HIV strategy that was developed in 2010. Anyway, by 2002, the first steps were taken toward this goal, and the CDC created what we call the National HIV Behavioral Surveillance System, or the NHBS, as a means to conduct behavioral surveillance among persons at high risk for HIV infection. The data that's collected from NHBS are used to provide a behavioral context for trends seen in HIV-reported cases. They also describe populations at increased risk for HIV infection, and thus provide an indication of the leading edge of the epidemic. Through systemic surveillance in groups at high risk for HIV infection, the NHBS is critical for monitoring the impact of the National HIV-AIDS Strategy, which focuses on decreasing HIV incidence, improving linkage to care, and reducing disparities. So right now, the surveillance is currently conducted in 20 jurisdictions, and they mainly are large urban cities where infection rates tend to be higher. These activities occur in rotating annual cycles among three different populations at high risk for HIV, including MSM, or men who have sex with men, injection drug users, or now the lingo is PWID, persons who inject drugs, and heterosexuals who are at increased risk for HIV infection. The goal of surveillance is to, one, assess the prevalence and trends in HIV infection, two, to assess HIV STI risk behaviors, three, to assess utilization and trends in HIV screening, linkage to care, and four, to assess compliance with antiretroviral treatments and effectiveness. So here's just some examples of the types of data and how they're used to be able to provide important information and feedback that helps guide HIV prevention efforts. And among these three, probably the one that's most noteworthy, well, they're all noteworthy, but had immediate impact was findings in 2008 cycle that was among MSM that produced findings that led to immediate impact in HIV prevention efforts across the country, in, particularly in large and urban areas with sizable populations of men who have sex with men, particularly MSM of color. And that one particular that particular cycle led to found that there were high rates of unawareness of HIV among MSM, and it was particularly among men of color and younger MSM, and that ended up leading to promotion of strategies and recommendations to strengthen efforts to promote at least annual HIV testing among MSM in general, but to increase targeted testing and prevention activities among young MSM and MSM of color in particular. So. All right, so the typical NHBS implementation approach is at the beginning we conduct formative research to inform subject recruitment and survey HIV specimen collection. This is a means to learn more about the population and collect qualitative information to help with sampling procedures. MSM are sampled, so we have two different means of sampling when we conduct these activities. One is venue-based sampling, and that occurs during the MSM cycle, where we kind of have to identify the venue universe of places where MSM go and use that to sample. The other two cycles, when we target heterosexuals and IDUs, we use respondent-driven sampling, which is basically a sort of a chain referral sampling technique. Here, the local NHBF staff select a small number of initial participants that act as seeds, and they end up recruiting other folks to get into the study. Interviewing generally occurs during the summer months, well, the latter half of the year, I should say, between June and December, and is conducted by face-to-face interviews by staff using tablets. Participants are also asked to undergo rapid HIV testing, and also other specimen testing may occur with certain populations. So, for example, this year we're doing ACV testing because we're focusing on injection drug users. Cash incentive is offered to encourage participation, and during RDS cycles, people receive an incentive for referring their network members. The goal every year is to sample between 450 to 500 participants annually. So there's general challenges to NHBS implementation, and in a minute or two, so I want to talk about those first, but then I'll talk about how the Indigenous Leader Outreach Model kind of helps deal with those barriers. So one of the general challenges is understanding the target population's attributes, how to reach them, the norms that are part of the subculture, and how these can impact surveillance activities. Another challenge is garnering support from gatekeepers in the broader community. A lot of our work happens in a community context, and very often there are people that have important information or can provide access to the populations that we're trying to involve in surveillance activities. So it's important to get their support. A third challenge is how to identify sites to be able to collect the data and address any type of logistical barrier that could be there. For example, is there enough space to do the survey? Is the physical space or the venue acceptable for participants to come and become involved in surveillance activities. Okay, and then there are specific challenges for cycles when we try to recruit MSM to participate. One of them has to do with the types of venues. Are they acceptable to the population? Another is obtaining venue owner approval. To be able to do this, we have to do it in a venue during the MSM cycle, and so we have to have permission from the owner to be able to use the space. During IDU and HED cycles, there are particular challenges that we face. Identifying potential seeds that can spur recruitment, these have to be individuals that are known as sociometric stars, that have large social networks and are able to refer a lot of individuals, versus people who just know two or three people in their circles wouldn't be useful. So, you know, one of the challenges is trying to identify folks that are really, you know, with broad social networks that will be able to funnel enough participants to be able to reach a decent sample size. Another challenge is knowledge of the target population networks and identifying, well, I just mentioned this, identifying those with a high likelihood of a sperm recruitment. Final challenge is identifying strategies for accessing target populations to facilitate their participation in the survey. So, for example, knowledge about the site's accessibility for the target population at risk is important. Is it easy to access? Are there reasons people may not want to come in a particular neighborhood to participate? Those are all important things to take into consideration that we have to kind of address when we're doing this work. Okay, so here I'm going to talk for a minute or two about the advantages that the Indigenous Leader Outreach Model provides to collecting this surveillance information. And some of these advantages have to do with the nature of the staff and using Indigenous individuals from these communities that we work in. Another advantage that I'll talk about in a minute has to do with the actual facilities where we're at and our reputation in those communities. And then the other have to do with the methods that are part of the Indigenous Leader Outreach Model. So first to talk about the staff, you know, clearly the values of using these staff are that the members are from targeted population and communities. So let me find this correct slide here. Okay, and as members of the population and communities that are the focus of surveillance, CRP staff can provide a pretty keen insight into the attributes, behaviors, and cultural norms of our target population. They also can provide other personal knowledge that can be a useful guide during the formative research process. Coming from the targeted populations, they possess important information about at-risk subgroups in the population. For example, during this current cycle, our staff have provided shared information about younger white injectors that are an important group that we want to sample. They've been able to provide information and link us to high-risk Puerto Rican injectors on the south side of Chicago, which were not previously known to us in our intervention work and are another important important group that we want to sample. One of our staff, through his personal outreach work and ties, linked us to an African-American methamphetamine user, MSM, who, you know, typically over the last several IDU cycles that the city has done before, they've not really reached this group, so we're trying to attempt to reach that group. But all this is because of the attributes of the outreach worker and them being part of the community and having these type of ties. Another advantage is that these staff typically carry the values, attitudes, and beliefs of the populations that we're trying to target. As such, they're able to help surveillance investigators kind of learn or know what's acceptable or reasonable for target population members, for example, regarding the length of the survey, is it too long or not, regarding their willingness to participate in specimen collection activities, surveying, and whether the incentive amount is appropriate or acceptable to target population members. Using Indigenous staff also is important because they possess knowledge of practices and behaviors. This is really important during the cycle we're in now, which is injection drug users. And for example, we have to make sure that the people that try to get into the study are, you know, bona fide injectors. So part of our training, we enlist the outreach worker staff, who are former injectors, to train the interviewers on injection practices in terms of, you know, what the practices are all about, what are the procedures that an individual goes through, because that's part of the screening process to determine whether someone is truly a drug injector. And so they play a key role in kind of teaching staff that may be college students that are serving as interviewers for us to really know what to look for to determine if someone is, you know, truly an injector. A related advantage of using them is that these staff are more likely to discern or receive truthful information for participants. Again, this concerns the current cycle we're in. For example, we get some individuals that may be homeless, trying to get into the study, but aren't truly drug injectors. It's very typical where we can ask one of our outreach staff to come in and help examine the person, for example, for track marks to see if they are legitimate track marks and to see if this person is really, you know, truly an injection drug user. But again, that's one of the values that they bring to the work that we do. Finally, as a result of their indigenous membership status, these staff typically serve as program representatives and legitimize the surveillance activities in the community in general. So they kind of serve as the face of the surveillance activities in these neighborhoods that we're in. So these are just some pictures of the types of work that we do. These aren't necessarily pictures taken during surveillance activities, but surveillance, these NHBS activities can, you know, have taken place in similar type settings, out in the field, in the van, in a field station, and using our staff as an entree into the population. All right. These are a list of advantages for using the indigenous outreach model. They have to do more with kind of how we deployed our sites in the field. The first one has to do with our field sites and our placement in communities at risk. So CLP has been conducting community-based preventions, as we've talked about for this presentation, for nearly 30 years. Our health outreach using the mobile van in particular has made our staff familiar with most Chicago communities at elevated risk for HIV. These geographic areas typically are the same ones where surveillance activities usually occur. The way that our HIV prevention and services programs have been targeted over the years has led to the continued expansion of field sites from 3 initial field locations to 5 current sites. As such, these sites are advantageous to NHVS surveillance recruitment efforts since they are geographically dispersed throughout the Chicago area, typically located in high-risk communities that are the focus of HIV surveillance and readily accessible by public transportation. Another advantage is that each of these fixed site locations has long-standing histories, thus good reputations. Our staff are known in the communities that we reach. Our offices are known in the communities that we reach. And so that conveys, I think, some level and sense of trust among folks that are recruited into the NHBS surveillance study. So, and Larry had better pictures, but here's some pictures of each of the field sites that I've got. The one on the left is the south side. The top right is our north side field office. The center bottom one is our west side office in Austin. And then the one on the far right bottom is our northwest side site in Humboldt Park. The last point I want to talk about is how the Indigenous Leader Outreach Model's ethnographic focus has been used in surveillance activities. Basically, the ethnographers team with outreach workers and field staff. So this can happen in the field during outreach rounds and or at a field site, for example, observing a syringe exchange program. The CDC has deemed ethnographic research an important part of surveillance activities. Formative research can help inform and guide implementation of data collection. So the CDC strongly encourages project sites around the country to hire an ethnographer to lead these activities. This backing by the CDC acknowledges the importance of obtaining relevant information in the natural environment and the attributes of the ethnographic approach, which pays attention to the context, meaning, and meaning in which social phenomena occur. Regarding this, key advantages to using COIP's indigenous model is our long history utilizing ethnographic methods to understand individual and community processes and to access knowledge that can be used to more effectively intervene in the HIV epidemic, to develop substance abuse harm reduction strategies, and to develop other related services for communities at risk for HIV. So as I said, the ethnographer typically teams with outreach workers and the field staff to be able to have access to the community. In terms of the task that the ethnographic team does, a lot of it is direct field observations in the community. For example, during the head cycle, NHBF staff accompany COIP outreach workers while they conduct outreach rounds to survey community areas to collect observational data to characterize neighborhoods and determine how best to implement surveillance activities. During the current IDU cycle, research teams have hung out with at syringe programs and joined outreach teams as they do mobile HIV testing at popular street areas where drug use activities are occurring, to be able to learn more about those scenes and who can serve as seats during recruitment. During the MSM cycle, the ethnographer and team conducted visits to known MSM venues across the city to characterize their populations and assess those physical locations to determine the feasibility for data collection. All right. Identifying key informant potential seeds for RDS, that's another task, important task that we do, as seeds are crucial for initiating RDS sampling. During head and IDU cycles, the ethnographer works with staff to identify key informants and seeds. A key advantage to their knowledge is that field staff have regular, often daily interactions with individuals who come to our field offices or to the van for syringe exchange, testing, and other health information. And they've developed relationships with participants and are able to learn about their social networks and their level of interaction and status in these networks. Working with field staff to analyze the collected analysis information is important to ensure that effective seeds are identified and distinct representative social networks are sampled. So I'm going to go to the next slide because I know I'm taking longer than I should. But in terms of like the results of this kind of work that we've done, if you'll notice the over years, our goal is 450 to 500. That first year, that 2012 cycle is an outlier. We ended up getting funded that year in September, and we didn't get IRB approval until November, and we started, I think, November 28. So in 4 weeks, we got close to 200 participants. So that I see that as a success. But every other year, we've been able to reach the goal of between 450 and 500. This year, we're already, I have there 300. We're actually about 350. And because of our model, we've been able to get folks to participate in testing nearly 100%, clearly in IDU cycles. We get a lot of participation in specimen collection, so we're able to have a good sense of what the seroprevalence is in the population that we're sampling. MSM tends to be a more difficult population to convince to test because they test so much that it's, you know, last year was the MSM cycle, and we would encounter folks in the at these sites that would be like, oh, not another HIV test. But regardless of that, we still got, you know, 83% to consent to testing. So anyway, I'll just conclude by, you know, reiterating that this model has been very useful in providing ethnographic expertise and learning about the communities that we're trying to reach to be able to get an effective sense of what the HIV trends are in those communities. Also by offering staff that are indigenous to the target population that can teach us about the folks that we're reaching and promote cooperation among the folks that we're trying to recruit. And by employing our community knowledge and community-based resources, such as our field sites, our band, to be able to support wider participation among the population. So I think next is Mary Ellen.